It's 9:06. Good morning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Well, WikiLeaks struck again over the weekend, as we all know by now, releasing a mountain of classified documents relating to the U.S. war effort in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The documents were made available to the New York Times, Der Spiegel, and The Guardian. The leaked documents suggest that things are really not going well in Afghanistan, among other things, and that Pakistan may even be colluding with the Taliban, something that's been rumored and suggested for years. Well, this hour, we'll take on this topic from two different directions. First, we'll speak with a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter from the New York Times about the story itself. Then, after 9:30, we'll talk about what the documents mean for the Allied war effort with an expert who has been an advisor to both General McChrystal, who was the commander in Afghanistan, and General Petraeus, who is the current commander. And by the way, we will not be taking calls in the second half of this hour. We'll take calls before our first guest until about 9:30, but we will not be taking calls in the second half hour. My first guest is Jane Perlez, chief correspondent for the New York Times in Pakistan. She was part of a team of reporters who won a Pulitzer Prize in 2009 for international reporting. She joins me by phone this morning. Jane Perlez, good morning and welcome to the program.
Good morning to you, John.
What was your first reaction to the WikiLeaks documents?
I was impressed by the volume, the detail in some of the reports, and the nature of how they are compiled. I mean, these are across the transom raw intelligence reports, which, by the way, are not very highly classified. So it was fascinating to see what the soldiers on the ground learn and hear from sources in Afghanistan.
Well, you mentioned you used the word volume in terms of describing the size of this package of documents, some 91,000 documents, I understand. How do you go through that much material and decide what's newsworthy?
Well, we were very lucky. We have a wonderful reporter here who specializes in what I guess is called computer-assisted reporting, Andy Lerner. And he was able to search the documents for us according to categories that we asked for, themes, names, places, timelines, and so forth. So that way we were able to get a better grip.
Well, in spite of the fact that there were some, as I said, 91,000 documents, do we assume that these documents were chosen for their support of whatever point of view the person who leaked them in the first place has? In other words, were these cherry-picked? And
not at all. I think these, I don't know how I don't know the details of how WikiLeaks got them or where they came from, but it's pretty clear that this was just, I would say, downloaded documents. I don't think there was any cherry-picking going on.
Okay. Because that was one of the things that was suggested early on, that this wasn't representative of the communications that have taken place. It was just a small part of what was out there. But you don't take that view.
I don't take that at all. I think that's a false assumption.
All right. Was there any consideration?
Having said that, though, I think it would be nice. It would be great if we had a more complete record. I mean, we would have been happy to have many times more, so that we had the complete record. But I have no notion that anything was cherry picked. I don't think the person who, I think this was just a straight download. I don't think people had time to cherry pick or read. I mean, if you saw the documents, I don't think you would need armies of people to go through and cherry pick.
Well, that's kind of what I thought, because just the sheer volume, it looks, you know, I mean, given the way computers work, if all of these were in a few directories, it would be easier to just grab the whole works and toss it out there rather than having to go through them one by one and decide, oh, yeah, I'll leak this one, but not that one.
Oh, no, no. This is just what you'd call, what we call in our business, a massive dump.
Okay. Was there any consideration given in terms of covering this story that some of this leaked material might hurt the war effort if it was published?
Yes, I think there was considerable thought given to that. And we redacted names, including Afghan and Pakistani names. We redacted places. We redacted details that we thought would give any aid and comfort to the enemy.
Take us through the process then, from the point where the material became available, which was over the weekend, and when it was published. I mean, you didn't really have a lot of time.
No. It became available about 3.5 weeks ago.
Okay.
So we, the New York Times, the Guardian, which is a daily newspaper in London, and Der Spiegel, the German weekly magazine, were contacted by WikiLeaks and told that there was a trove of documents, and would we be interested in looking at them? So one of our correspondents, Eric Schmidt, who covers terrorism and is extremely familiar with the military, took the first look. And after it was decided that these were authentic documents and they were what they were said to be, a number of us who report on different aspects of Afghanistan and Pakistan looked at them and worked with Andy, our computer reporter, to sort of divide up the categories. And we looked at them according to our specialties. So I looked at the reports that basically specialized or mentioned Pakistan and the Pakistani intelligence agency.
800-642-1234 is the number to call if you want to join the program between now and 9:30, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org, or you can go to the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page and leave something there, and we'll put that out for people as well. What, as far as you're concerned, what was the most important aspect of the leaked documents?
Well, because I cover Pakistan and I am there almost all of the time, and it's a very difficult place to cover, because although the United States and Pakistan are ostensibly allies, there are many things that each side doesn't tell the other. So it was very revealing to see the volume of reports and the details in the reports that dealt with the question of the ISI and its involvement with the Afghan Taliban, which have safe haven inside Pakistan, which essentially granted safe haven in Pakistan, to see the links between the ISI and the Afghan Taliban, and how the Afghan Taliban, with the encouragement of the ISI, does run suicide bombing attacks, various other kinds of attacks across the border from Pakistan into Afghanistan to attack American and NATO troops.
Yeah, that was one of the early things that came out of this. It was a big headline, and since you are in Pakistan, you must have heard about rumors, or I mean, this has been talked about for a long time. You suddenly see it confirmed. What has the reaction been? What reaction have you gotten about that aspect of the story since it came out?
Well, in Pakistan, at first there was mostly silence. We gave the Pakistani military and the ISI and the presidency quite 36 hours warning, and gave them questions, just as we gave the White House questions, about the documents. And we said that the documents say that the ISI backs the Afghan Taliban, and what did they have to say? And we got one response from the ISI saying that we have no response until we examine the documents, which is fair enough. Yesterday, the ISI said that the documents represented the usual maligning nature of the Western press, and that these were unfair documents, that I guess they said they weren't true, and that that Pakistan would proceed to fight the militants with or without the West's help. In other words, a kind of implicit threat that, okay, the United States doesn't like us, we can go elsewhere for friends. And there were other, and I, that was the main reaction. The presidency, the president is Asif Ali Zardari, who has been supported to a great extent by the United States. His spokesman put out a statement saying that Pakistan remained a friend of the United States.
Was there a smoking gun in these documents in terms of that relationship between the Pakistani intelligence arm and the Taliban?
Well, I've been asked this a lot. I mean, look, American policymakers, the top military officers of this country, the top diplomats have known about this for a long time. How much they bring it up with their counterparts in Pakistan, I don't know the specifics, but I have a pretty good idea that it's brought up quite often. And in fact, the American military made no secret. They publicly said last year and earlier this year that they wanted the Pakistani military to take action against the Afghan Taliban. They wanted the Pakistani military to fight against the Afghan Taliban in North Waziristan, which is their main stronghold, and where the Pakistani military allows the Afghan Taliban to have its sanctuary. And the Pakistanis have refused to do so. And actually, for a very good reason, because Pakistan sees the Afghan Taliban as its asset. They see it as a very important instrument for the end game in Afghanistan. Pakistan believes that the United States will leave Afghanistan probably sooner than later, and they don't want a void in Afghanistan. They want their people, the Afghan Taliban, to have some say, to have a sphere of influence. So I think it's very difficult for the Americans to persuade the Pakistanis to change their whole national security outlook, which is what it would amount to. Asking the Pakistanis to turn on the Afghan Taliban is asking them to basically turn their national security policy on its head. And the reason that the Pakistanis want the Afghan Taliban in Afghanistan is they see it as a counterweight to India. India, the Pakistanis believe, has influence in Afghanistan, and they don't want Afghanistan to become a wholly owned subsidiary of India, which is unlikely, but that's their fear. So the Afghan Taliban are kind of a proxy in this war between this active, well, it hasn't been active for a while, but this enmity between Pakistan and India.
Yeah, and that's something that most Americans probably don't even think of when they think about the situation in Afghanistan is how the Pakistanis view India, and that's a real important omission in our thinking, and we don't
absolutely
get a lot of
absolutely. I mean, it is very complicated. It is somewhat complicated, and it's hard to explain. And I think American policymakers find it hard to explain. And one of the reasons I think that American policymakers find it hard to explain is that a key to solving all of this would be solving the main tension point between Pakistan and India, which is Kashmir. And this has caused three wars between Pakistan and India. Pakistanis claim it, the Indians claim it. And if somehow there could be some peace over Kashmir, then Pakistan wouldn't feel so, if you like, paranoid about India's presence in Afghanistan, because the tensions between Pakistan and India would be reduced. But the Americans have found it very, very difficult for a variety of reasons to tackle this nut problem of Kashmir, which is at the bottom of the Pakistani-India tension.
We're talking this morning with Jane Perlis, chief correspondent for The New York Times in Pakistan, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. And we have some callers who want to join the program. We'll take those calls in just a moment. I'll give the phone number again because we still have a couple of lines available, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. And the email is talk@wpr.org. You can also leave a message on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of WPR. 921, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Coming up later on today on the Ideas Network, after 2 on Talk of the Nation, a look at the highlights from the International AIDS Conference, plus actor and comedian Jonah Hill takes your questions. That's after 2 o'clock today on Talk of the Nation. This hour, we're talking about Afghanistan and Pakistan in the wake of the WikiLeaks story, which broke over the weekend. And my guest in this portion of the program is Jane Perlis, chief correspondent for the New York Times in Pakistan. After 9:30, I'll be talking with Anthony Cordesman, who is an expert on strategy and who has given advice to both General McChrystal, the former commander in that area, and now gives advice to General Petraeus, and is also a national security analyst for ABC News. We won't be taking calls in that half of the program. Let's go to the phones and talk to Tom in Franklin first. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. You know, I find your guest very insightful in the situation in Pakistan and Afghanistan. I have a question, two questions really, more to the point of the leaking of the information in the, into the news. And is this coincidental to looking for refunding of the Afghan war? And secondly, in a kind of a different question, is the aspect of treason something that should be talked about in the case of this young man that actually leaked the information, and what sort of government charges could be brought against that person?
Jane Perlis, do we even know who leaked it?
Sorry?
Do we even know who leaked the information?
No, WikiLeaks has not told us who leaked it.
What about the caller's comment about the timing of the release?
Well, I don't think it was timed particularly to anything. I don't know the history of how long he's held it for, but I don't think he held it and then decided to release it. But it does turn out to be a very interesting and pivotal moment for them to be released, because I think the weariness in Congress is beginning to show through. So, for example, last week, Senator Lugar, who is the chief Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, expressed some frustration with the Afghan war, and he's been pretty solid supporter. And then very quickly after we ran our story on Sunday night on the web, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Kerry, put out a statement pretty much saying that he thought the documents were very worrying and that, you know, we should be looking deeper into how the war was being conducted and what progress was being made. So I think you'll see the documents contributing a lot to the debate that was beginning to percolate, but will now, I think, do more than that.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Let's go next to Ray in Milwaukee. Ray, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for this discussion. I want to bring the guests back to the reason we're in Afghanistan, which is what happened on 9/11. And apparently the ISI, the head of the ISI, had wire transferred $100,000 to Mohammed Atta weeks before 9/11. Now, in the 9/11 commission report, the commissioners actually said on page 172 that that wasn't important who funded the hijackers on 9/11. If anybody doesn't believe me, just go online and go to 172 of the 9/11 commission report. And to me, this is insane, because we're in this war presumably because Pakistan had funded the hijackers. Now we have allied ourselves with the Pakistanis. Now this would be like in World War II, allying ourselves with Mussolini to fight against Hitler. To me, the ones guilty of treason are in our own government. I'll take answers off the air.
Thanks for the call, Ray. Was there some, just if you want to comment on that, go ahead.
Well, I haven't read the commission's report in a long time, and I should know the detail that the caller is referring to, but I don't. I think he does raise, moving on though, he does raise an interesting question. President Obama has said that we are in Pakistan to destroy Al-Qaeda, essentially, that's the focal point. And I think that gets lost a lot in the discussion. I think there's a lot of discussion about implicit nation building, about defeating the Taliban, whatever that might mean. But people seem to forget that the real reason that we're there
in fighting this war is to make sure that Al-Qaeda cannot hit the United States again or cannot hit Western Europe, does not have the capacity to do that. Now, the question then becomes, is the way that we're going about the war in Afghanistan achieving that? And I think that those are the questions that will probably be asked in Washington in the coming weeks as war financing bills come up, and presumably will be at the bottom and at the heart of the big review that President Obama has promised for December.
What is the what's the attitude of in Pakistan generally toward this conflict? I mean, what's the attitude toward the United States? The Pakistanis that you talk to, what are they saying? What are they thinking?
Well, let's take roughly educated Pakistanis who are very religious and who've been to madrasas or believe in the religious system of schooling. They believe that the United States is essentially the enemy and that the United States should be defeated at all costs and should get out of Afghanistan, that they are invaders and that they are there to defeat the Muslims and that this is not tolerable. So that's one class of people, and they support the Afghan Taliban who go across the border and fight American soldiers. They support them in principle anyway. And one should remember that against that, behind that is extremely negative opinion of the United States in Pakistan. I mean, I think the approval rating of the United States in Pakistan at the moment might be in single digits. Since I've been there in the last 3 years, I don't think it's ever been above 15 to 17%. Among the educated class, very slim, slender sliver at the top, there's great suspicion of the United States. A lot of people won't come here. They are really offended by the attitude that they meet at the borders. I know well-to-do businessmen who have homes and women who have homes in London and Europe but who will not come to the United States. They admire some aspects of the United States, but they really don't admire the foreign policy.
Going forward, and this will be kind of a wrap-up question here, what do you think the ultimate significance of the leak of these documents is going to be?
Well, I think it's going to be very interesting, John, to see how they contribute to the debate on the war in Afghanistan. Obviously, this is a very difficult, troubling war. 9 years out, and the Taliban are stronger than they've ever been. $300 billion spent, and where are we? So I think that these documents will be an element in that. I don't think that these documents are, over-the-top, significant, secret documents of war plans, of predictions by our senior-most officials of what's going to happen. But I do think that they are an interesting, on-the-ground mosaic, if you like, of what's going on there and how difficult it is for our soldiers and our military to fight that war.
Jane Prillis, thank you for spending this time with us this morning. I really appreciate it.
It was a great pleasure.
Jane Prillis is a chief correspondent for the New York Times in Pakistan, and she was also part of a team of reporters who won a Pulitzer Prize in 2009 for international reporting. She joined us by phone this morning, and we really appreciate that. Coming up next, we're going to talk to an expert who gives advice to the U.S. military on strategy in Afghanistan and get his reaction to the documents that were leaked by WikiLeaks and were made public over the weekend. They were leaked, as you heard, about 3.5 weeks ago, but they just were finally published over the weekend in three different newspapers in three different countries. And there's probably a story in terms of why they were made available to those particular papers and so forth. We probably aren't going to get into that. But what we will be talking about is what these leaks have to do with the strategy going forward in Afghanistan. How important Is there some damage to the operational security of U.S. forces in Afghanistan? Will there be some effect on what people are willing to put into reports and put into writing? There have been a number of different stories which have come out of this. The release of these papers, as you might expect, I mean, with 91,000 different documents, there will be stories coming out on this probably for weeks before they run out of stuff, and maybe even longer than that. So this is going to be a story for a long time, and we're just now starting to really come to grips with it. My next guest is Anthony Cordesman, Arleigh A. Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, who also acts as a national security analyst for ABC News. He has been an advisor to General McChrystal when he was the commander in Afghanistan, and he also advises General Petraeus, who is the current commander there. Good morning, Anthony Cordesman, and thank you for joining us today.
Good morning.
The release of the classified material on the war in Afghanistan suggests that things are not going very well there. Do these documents provide an accurate picture of what's happening on the ground?
Well, the answer is no, not because there's something wrong with the documents, but because of the timing involved. These are, really, the bulk of them are several years old. The most recent reports virtually predate the implementation of the build-up and the new strategy. They provide a good picture in many ways of what was happening on the ground. But it's very important to realize the dates here. And very often people who are not familiar with what's actually happening think that the surge happened last year or it happened early this spring. And in fact, we are just beginning to complete the final stages of the military buildup. We're still some time away from completing the civilian buildup, particularly in moving people into the field. The basic implementation of the new strategy is just beginning to be tested in Helmand, and the major operation in Kandahar has not begun as a population-centric strategy, although operations are occurring on the periphery of Kandahar and in dealing with the networks. And I think this is a very important point to realize, because as you look through these releases, they do provide a lot of very useful information on the war, but it is fundamentally historical in character.
There's, of course, there's been lots of comment about this, as one might expect, and one comment or one opinion that I read among the hundreds that I probably looked at, I didn't read all of them, there's just so much. One of the problems with covering something like this is the information overload. But operational security is a critical factor in the success or failure of any military operation. What does this leak of these documents do to us operationally in terms of the war effort?
Well, you raise a very good question, and we can be absolutely certain that perhaps some of the most attentive readers of this series of leaks consist of the insurgents, Al-Qaeda, people in Pakistan who are not necessarily friendly to the United States, and virtually anyone else who wants to understand U.S. operations, including people in areas like Iraq. Now, almost none of the material by itself gives away a unique picture of operational details. And where there are leaks that could be potentially of some importance, like identifying a given unit which operates in secret, the leaks are relatively limited in character, but these patterns are important. And what is also different is they're all in one place. And we need to remember that hostile groups are not really equipped to do the kind of intelligence or media analysis that Western intelligence groups are. So simply having this kind of document to read has an impact on operational security.
And another comment that came out was that, you know, instability is the weapon of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. I mean, they rely on it, being able to create it and to use it. I'm just going to make an assumption, which is always a dangerous thing, that the release of these documents more or less aids that instability, at least in some respect.
It's very hard to tell. I think that in some ways these documents clear the air. And for Pakistan, for example, there are issues which have been covered again and again in the media, but the very fact that there was official U.S. reporting on some of these tensions and problems to some extent pushes Pakistan to confront them a little more frankly and a little more openly. There are a lot of areas where much is going to depend on the follow-up. One problem that you really have here is, first, we don't know how the insurgents, the hostile groups, are going to use this. We've already seen a whole group of new conspiracy theories emerge in sources like the Pakistani press. That will be a problem, but those conspiracy theories were basically going on continuously for months before this, if not years. What really may be damaging in terms of impact is what happens when the insurgents quote out of context, spin the data, mix their own ideology with what are real U.S. reports, and use it as a propaganda weapon to provoke this kind of instability. Another key issue is how well the United States and ISAF are going to react. One thing that's very clear from these documents, if you are reading both official sources legitimately and seeing things released like this, is how poorly the United States in general has communicated on the war. You have, unfortunately, a set of filters in the White House that have blocked a lot of the efforts to report on the war. There have been efforts by ISAF to provide monthly and three-monthly reports on the status. And essentially, the reason they haven't been issued and made public is resistance from the U.S., not other countries. If you go back last month, something that never got much attention but is fairly striking to those of us who have to work with this day by day, is the Department of Defense is charged with issuing a series of semi-annual reports on the status of the war. And it prepared some fairly good ones, as well as some very political ones in the past. Well, in June, all of a sudden, it issued the report that was supposed to have been issued 6 months earlier that dated back to the Bush administration. And a lot of this was little more than propaganda. Then within a few weeks, it issued a report that was in considerably more depth and considerably more accurate, that was prepared as a result of the new strategy. So you had two contradictory reports on the status of the war. You had exactly the same thing with reporting on the Afghan National Security Forces, which is a key component. And if we keep this up, no transparency, we don't earn trust, we don't provide a picture of what's actually happening, then you're right. It's not simply a matter of instability. You're making these the authentic reports simply by default.
Well, what's the reason for the, for lack of a better term, the communication strategy that the administration is using with regard to the war?
Well, I think one has to be careful about using the term administration. One of the more striking aspects of both the Iraq and the Afghan war is when we talk about the administration, the State Department has never issued a meaningful report on either war ever under either administration. It has been essentially a void of silence. There's been occasionally useful testimony, but that's it. The Department of Defense has been charged by Congress with providing reporting. And if you look at the reporting that has come out of the Department of Defense on both wars, and for listeners, it's available at what's called Defense Link on the web, it's often quite good. There is a tendency to spin and distort and provide a more favorable picture, but at least recently it's been limited. You also have, when you talk about the administration, cooperation with an arm of Congress, which is the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction. Where the problem seems to have been is in the White House, and particularly in not so much the National Security Council, but the people who are always attempting to control the message, to spin it and make it favorable to the president. And the problem has been that they've controlled the message so well that there hasn't been any message. Essentially, aside from the president's speeches, which are prepared by other people, there's been virtually no meaningful attempt to communicate what's happening in the war that's come out, and often they've ended up blocking or delaying reporting from other elements of the administration, like the Department of Defense.
But what's the motivation for that?
It's a good question. First, I think you'd have to ask them, but I think part of the problem is that this endless desire to control the message often leads to no message, and it is just a matter of kind of constantly trying to create filters and barriers to anyone else communicating, regardless of the impact.
We're talking about, well, the genesis of this program, of course, was the leak of classified material over the, well, the leak occurred several weeks ago, but the release occurred over the weekend, and there's been a lot of fallout from that. WikiLeaks published some 91,000 documents relating to the war in Afghanistan, and people have been reacting and responding to that ever since. We're talking about it this hour. We spent the first half hour talking with a reporter who covers the story over in Pakistan. And in this half of the program, where I'm talking with Anthony Cordesman, the Arleigh A. Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, who also acts as a national security analyst for ABC News, who has given advice to General McChrystal when he was the commander in Afghanistan, and also gives advice to General Petraeus on strategy. We're not taking any calls in this half of the program, and we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back, and I have more questions for Professor Cordesman, and we'll get to that in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:45. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn for this week and next week. Next hour, I'll be talking about with the authors of a new book titled Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. That's coming up next hour here on the Ideas Network. This hour, WikiLeaks put out 91,000 documents or so about what's going on in Afghanistan and Pakistan. These documents were made available to the New York Times, Der Spiegel, and The Guardian. They were published over the weekend. We're dealing with the aftermath of that and talking about it. My guest in this portion of the program is Anthony Cordesman, Arleigh A. Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, who also acts as a national security analyst for ABC News. Well, the Obama administration has downplayed the significance of the WikiLeaks story, which is what we would expect them to do. Going forward, how significant is this event for the Obama administration?
Well, it's really hard to tell because, again, you raised an important question earlier. We don't know what the insurgent reaction is. We don't know as yet the full range of reactions from people hostile to the United States and how they will alter and spin this story. We don't know how people who look at these issues, not in terms of the past, but looking forward, are going to react. There's already right now a crisis going on because of a major incident where the Afghans claim that there was a very, very serious number of civilian casualties where the U.S. has indicated there's no reporting. And certainly from now on, anyone who looks at civilian casualties is going to look at this. Similarly, in Pakistan, whatever happens, even though these are not particularly new, everyone's going to look at the reports, and this has already led to people from the Pakistani intelligence service reacting. You are going to see allies reacting, and for many allies, frankly, the coverage of the war has been far less limited or far less detailed than it has in the United States. So people are going to read through this and get a much more realistic picture of war than is always communicated in the European media. But we also need to remember where we're headed. It's very likely today that you're going to have the last vote on funding the war that the Congress has to make between now and its vote on next year's budget submission, which at the earliest would not come until June of next year. The buildup of troops and civilians is already pretty well complete. The president has already had his replacement for General McChrystal. So in practical terms, there are no major political events on this aside from the coming election, where it's more likely that there will be more conservative Republican supporters of the war at the end of that than there are now. The next key set of events also has very little to do with these leaks. General Petraeus has to make some decisions about his approach to strategy, including whether he changes the policy on civilian casualties and on airstrikes. That will be an event where these may have some impact, but again, it's where we're headed that counts far more than the past. Also, there is a report due to Congress in November, which is a key focus of the U.S. national security structure in the White House. That won't be reporting on the past as WikiLeaks did. It will be reporting on the level of success the new strategy has and has not had to date. And that's going to be a key focus for everyone, particularly because it will come after the election and be something that will probably get far more attention in terms of how the Congress and the media cover the war in the future. I think these are things to remember, because what is a little striking is when you look through all of this vast pool of documents and the media coverage on it, it's gotten more coverage in the last few days than I have seen of any of the reporting coming out of the Department of Defense or the ISAF command in Afghanistan that actually shows the current situation in the war or describes where the strategy is headed. And that dichotomy does give you the strange picture that if you have what appears to be a mysterious leak, you get far more attention, regardless of the content, than you do to what actually is happening in the war.
Earlier, when you were talking about where the information is coming from and the lack of transparency and so forth, you mentioned that it was significant that the State Department has been completely mute, pretty much. Does this suggest, are they just not involved in the strategy going forward in Afghanistan? And the reason I bring this up is that Jane Perlis, who was on just before we started talking to you, was talking about the fact that it's there's a significant thing that doesn't get reported at all, and that is she said that the Pakistanis needed the Taliban from their point of view as a balance against India. And we don't even talk about India. We don't hear about it in news reporting. It's certainly not something that gets discussed a lot. But that this was a key factor in the Pakistani attitude toward the Taliban was that they felt that they were a balance against Indian influence in Afghanistan.
Well, in fairness, I think that first administration witnesses have testified on this. But the problem with the testimony is that, while the rest of the world has advanced fairly quickly, the Congress is terrible at actually getting testimony up on the web and particularly getting testimony up on a timely basis. There has been a lot of reporting on Pakistan using Afghanistan as strategic depth against India. And that's mentioned in the Department of Defense reporting, and it has been for at least half a decade. But again, this is a semi-annual report that most people don't seem to pay attention to, although it has a great deal more declassified data than any other report on the war. But the State Department, in fairness, does play a really critical role. This is a population-centric war. And what that means is that the State Department's role in providing aid, in sending people out to the provincial reconstruction teams, in building up the capacity of the Afghan government, in providing aid to the Pakistani government that helps win Pakistani support for military operations, has been absolutely critical. The problem has been that there has been almost no meaningful reporting, in fact, no meaningful reporting coming out of the State Department on this, aside from sort of standard public relations releases, most of which are at best topical and none of which provide any overview of the effectiveness of the State Department's role.
The you mentioned at the beginning of the interview here that the material in the WikiLeaks is sort of a rearview mirror look at what has happened in the past and doesn't reflect what's going on in Afghanistan right now. We are just now completing, as you pointed out, the build-up to the 30,000 troops that will be going in, and I guess we can call it the surge, really hasn't even started yet. What is your assessment of how likely that strategy is to accomplish the goals that the administration has set for it?
I think that it's very much a matter of uncertainty. I don't mean by that that the odds are necessarily bad, but I think that in formulating the new strategy last summer, everyone recognized that this was a high-risk strategy, not so much because the insurgents are that strong. We're talking something on the order of 30 to 40,000 full-time and part-time fighters and probably 10,000 cadres. But the fact is that this is not the only problem. As the WikiLeaks material does make clear, Pakistan has different objectives. It has not always been frank or cooperative, although it's been increasingly cooperative in the last year. You have a very weak Afghan government. And if you look at, again, the one report that is official, that's sort of topical on this, which is the Department of Defense report on DefenseLink, what's really striking is that in a good part of the country, there is little or no meaningful Afghan presence from the Afghan government, and there is very little local confidence in security. You have the problems in a 46-country alliance, where substantial country contributions are made by countries which are not willing to take risks, which are not willing to fight, which do not comply with the regulations for using aid in Afghanistan, and often don't keep their pledges by providing the level of aid they're supposed to keep. You have a UN structure, which is now under a relatively competent new leader, but in the entire history of the Afghan war, the group in the UN that's supposed to coordinate aid, which is called UNAMA, has never issued a report on aid and its overall impact. Nor is it clear that it's ever conducted an audit of the aid effect. And when we hear a lot about Afghan corruption, it's important to note that the main source of the level of corruption is the sheer lack of any control over the contract money of billions and billions of dollars worth of aid and defense contracts that flows to power brokers. These are risks where the new strategy is designed to deal not simply with the military dimension, but the civil side, to operate at a local level where the Afghan people are convinced that they will be protected, that a government is being built up that will serve their interests, and that Afghan forces are going to be coming in that will be the forces that protect them. And in all of these areas, there's been really major progress over the course of the last year. But that progress is not the kind of progress that people had hoped for when they drafted the new strategy and the president's review was taking place. And it is still uncertain in effect.
Well, this is just, it's such an incredibly complex story to cover. There's so many layers to it. And let's face it, the American public now seems to have the attention span of a fly. So that makes it even harder. I appreciate your being with us this morning and helping to provide some clarifications on all of this. It's been very educational for me, I know, at least.
Thanks, John. It was a pleasure.
Anthony Cordesman has been my guest in this half of the program. He is the Arleigh A. Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and acts as a National Security Analyst for ABC News. Earlier in the program, we heard from Jane Perlis, Chief Correspondent for the New York Times in Pakistan and a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. This program was produced by Chrissy Pease, on-air production by Rhonda Fanning and Dave Potraz. Thanks to them as well. Stick around. We'll see what's coming up after the news. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of WPR.